Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is writer Andrea L. Smalley. She is Professor Emerita of History at Northern Illinois University, and we're talking about her new book, The Market in Birds, Commercial Hunting, Conservation, and the Origins of Wildlife Consumerism, 1850 to 1920. Andrea, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Okay, well, thank you for having an interest in it.
This is a fascinating book, but it's also a tremendously sad book for me because it testifies, I know that's sort of a weird thing, testifies to how much wildlife and habitat we have lost in a relatively short period of time. As you write in your book, you talk about the loss of avian abundance, and it's startling to read how much birds were consumed in this.
Oh, yes, definitely. And it gets almost tedious in the sources when they talk about the numbers. There's always long sort of descriptions of how many birds are shipped in by railroads or how many were killed in a pigeon shoot. And it's just tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands at a time. And it's hard to imagine that there was anything left after all of that killing.
Well, in some cases, there wasn't. They had to keep moving west.
Yes.
Well, before we start talking about what we're about market shooting, this book has been written in a strange way with Henry M. Reeves. Can you talk about that?
Oh, sure. So Henry Milt Reeves, better known as Milt, he's a wildlife biologist and had a 30-year career with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And he ended his career as the branch chief of migratory bird management in Washington, D.C. So somebody who knows something about birds. The researcher has written a number of books and articles about birds and other wildlife. But he was also kind of as a hobby collecting historical stuff about hunting and wild birds. And he began to compile a manuscript about market hunting. And he just collected a mass of material, mostly published sources from the 19th century and into the early 20th century about market hunting. And this was a kind of a retirement project for him. He unfortunately passed away before he could finish it. And his family, particularly his wife, Marilyn, was interested in seeing this book finished. And so through a variety of connections, I got in contact with her. Wow. And I agreed to complete the manuscript. So started in on it, did some of my own research and kind of reconstructed. It's probably not the book he had envisioned originally, but I hope that he would have appreciated the finished product.
Now, there's another person in this book that you sort of follow through their entire career, and that's Henry Clay Merritt. Can you talk about him?
Oh, sure. He's a great character, and he's a fantastic source for market hunting. I often say if he didn't exist, I would have had to invent him. Because his career spanned pretty much the entirety of the market hunting era. He was a market hunter and a game dealer, and he was, as I said, his career pretty much did sort of followed the rise and fall of market hunting as a business. And he was late in his life, in the early 20th century, after he retired from the game business, he wrote a book called The Shadow of a Gun. And part of that book was a memoir of his time in the game business. And so it makes this fabulous source for getting at the kind of day-to-day operations of the game business and also just kind of the history of the game business as well. And it's, I'd say, a unique source because most of the sources you have available about market hunting either come from critics who are going to, believe the worst about market hunters, and or you have sources that were published a little bit after the market hunting era. So they would be things that written by kind of old market hunters, kind of these nostalgic pieces looking back at the market hunting era and kind of romanticizing it, kind of nostalgically romanticizing it. So either one has a little bit of, you know, you have to read those with a little bit of suspicion. Merritt is writing at the time that market hunting is still legal, and he's somebody who's kind of worked in the guts of market hunting. So he's an interesting character and a great source.
And he himself changes attitude towards market hunting.
Yeah, I mean, to some extent. I mean, he, in the end, I mean, he's a very complex person because he's in some ways a nature lover.
Yep.
He loves birds. He loves being outdoors. He's a keen observer of nature, but he's also a businessman and he's looking for profit, and so he's kind of in between. You know, he sees this abundance of birds. He decries the fact that the birds are disappearing, and that the paradise, this avian abundance, is gone. He decries that. But he's also interested in making a profit, and he sees the benefits of what he considers to be benefits of providing birds to everyone in the country, that it's not just monopolized by an elite group of sportsmen, but that the game dealer can provide wild game for anyone in the country. So he sees it as democratizing.
Yeah. In your book, which is the great thing about it, is it addresses all these nuances and ideas and philosophies and feelings. The market gunning area we're talking about is post-Civil War.
Right.
Generally the end of the 19th and the early 20th century. And market hunters, as you write about in your book, are that weird person who is part outdoorsman, part businessman. And in order to be that, they had to shoot huge volumes of wildfowl. I mean, just amazing. And then ship them east to people who were eating them, people who were putting them on their hats. And you also address feather hunters and eggers, people
right.
who are eating eggs. And it's just amazing. And it just sort of spiraled out of control really quickly. There was no, at that time, there were no game regulations, so there was no bag limit. People could hunt in spring when birds were nesting. They could hunt at night. There was no restrictions on the kinds of guns they used. Some of them used these it's amazing array of cannons from a small boat. That photograph in your book is insane. That looked like an accident waiting to happen.
And there often were accidents that, you know.
I have to believe that. I mean, that's not a stretch.
Yeah.
But the amount of birds that they're shooting is just frightening. They're literally talking about wagon loads of prairie chickens and waterfowl. It was amazing, but it was a huge lucrative business.
Oh, definitely. I mean, talk about numbers. There's, as I said, it almost gets kind of overly repetitive. The stories about, you know, you could take some of these weapons like the punt guns or big guns, what they called them, that would shoot waterfowl. They could get over 100 birds in a single shot. Some of the records were like 180 birds at one shot. Hunters could kill maybe 12,000 birds in a season. A New York supplier provided 20,000 pigeons for a target shooting in Coney Island in 1881.
And those were passenger pigeons.
And those are passenger pigeons. A little wonder why they're extinct.
Right.
so,
what,
yeah.
What was fascinating about reading your book, though, is it shows how far east large amounts of wildfowl used to exist. I mean, It's not like, you know, everybody now thinks way out west as if you want to see big waterfowl concentrations. But man, all this stuff, canvasbacks, you know, all this stuff was game and was marketing. And you also write about how this was the commercialization of wildlife. And that's an interesting idea, that sort of capitalism gets hold of wildlife and just sees it as nothing more than a tool or a something that you can barter with for money.
Right. It's a commodity. And that's really, I mean, one of the things I'm trying to emphasize here in the book is that this sale of wildlife, which certainly has gone on before then.
But on a much smaller scale,
Right.
People would shoot, locally would shoot and then sell to the local people.
Right. So much smaller scale. And this, as long as there's been trade and exchange, people have traded and exchanged wildlife and wildfowl. What happens in the late 19th century, though, is this transition point where this becomes a kind of modern capitalist enterprise that has all the characteristics of sort of modern industrial consumer capitalism. So it's interstate and it's even international in some cases. It has a system of prices and profits. It has specialized divisions of labor where one group of people is in charge of harvesting it, another group of people are processing, another group of people are transporting, another group of people are storing wildfowl. There's retailers, wholesalers, commission agents.
It's amazing.
A whole host of...
It's a whole network of people working on this project.
Right. Yeah. This is a business that relies on technological innovations in transportation and communication. It has segmented markets. It makes use of advertising, catalogs, mail order. So it's a modern business, and that's what's different about it from what had existed in the previously. So I think it's really, it arises at that transition point between this older form of wildlife use and then this modern capitalist form.
As you mentioned before, there had to be technological advances to allow it to get to the level that it did. One of them was trains. Trains were essential to the market gunning.
Yes, definitely. Because there's no way you're going to have that large, that sort of bigger scale that allows you to send birds from the West to the East Coast. I mean, New York City was a huge consumer of wild game, had huge game markets. Boston, Philadelphia, cities that have huge markets in game. And Chicago does too, but Chicago's a railroad hub. So it's both a retailer and wholesaler of wild game. But yeah, the railroads were crucial to this. And going back to Henry Clay Merritt, his business relied on the availability of train transportation and reliable train transportation. You need transportation that will get to the East Coast quickly before your birds spoil. So as trains kind of extended westward, you got into new areas where you could harvest more birds. The trains became more reliable. You started to have express trains so you could ship game.
Well, they had special duck trains.
Oh, yes. Yeah, in certain places they would have trains where hunters could get on and take off across the prairies. The engineer would stop and let them off whenever there was shooting to be had, and they'd go out and shoot and then get back on and load their ducks on the train.
Now, so the other technology that had to be improved was refrigeration. It was really sort of disturbing from my stomach point of view that reading about these, you know, they would just pack them in a barrel with some sawdust and then ship them east. And people were actually, well, you know, they need to be a bit, quote, tender. That was okay.
Yes.
In other words, rotten.
Right. It improved the flavor.
Oh, my God. I know. But refrigeration was critical. People built local ice houses. Where they could store the game for up to a year or sometimes more.
Yes. Yeah. And this was one of the, again, Henry Clay Merritt innovated on building these freezing rooms purchased butcher boxes, these kind of patented butcher boxes for freezing wild game, and you know, would keep tens of thousands of birds in these freezers. And he built freezers in multiple cities along railroad lines to be able to buy birds from hunters operating farther west and keep them. And this was really important for the development of the game business. But it also, you talk about taste, one of the changes that had to happen was also a change in consumer taste, because earlier in the 19th century, people would not think about eating frozen meat.
That's right.
Meat had to be fresh, and people thought freezing meat would spoil it. It might even turn it poisonous. So you had to get this shift in 19th century taste to allow for people being willing, consumers being willing to buy frozen meat. And these changes are the same changes that are happening that allow the beef industry to grow, the Western cattle industry. You don't have, you know, your cattle ranches in the West unless you have the same changes in railroad technology and refrigeration technology that allows that to happen. So those changes that are going on in the beef industry are the same changes that are driving the wild game industry.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer Andrea L. Smalley. She's professor emerita of history at Northern Illinois University, and we're talking about her new book, The Market in Birds: Commercial Hunting, Conservation, and the Origins of Wildlife Consumerism, 1850 to 1920. Andrea, let's switch the focus to the market itself, like in Boston, in New York, or Chicago. Many people today would not realize that when you went to a market, you wouldn't just see chickens and geese hanging up. You would see all sorts of wildfowl hanging up.
Oh, definitely. And other kinds of wild game, too. I mean, you could buy venison, rabbits. Certain times a year, you could buy elk or bear in some places.
There was a lot of shorebirds. I mean, the big ones, especially like willets and godwits and stuff like that. Those were all regularly featured in the market. Woodcock were huge.
Yes. Yeah, and very expensive. They were, by pound, probably the most expensive game bird sold. But yeah, the kinds of birds that were in the market could... There would be birds that, yeah, you would kind of expect, you know, ducks and geese, turkeys, those you'd kind of expect as something to eat. But smaller birds, smaller game birds like woodcock were fairly common. But also
bobolinks.
Bobolinks, yes. Small, you know, perching birds and songbirds could end up in the market. Robins, you could buy bushel baskets of robins or blackbirds for robin pie or blackbird pie. Which were, you know, in some parts of the country were kind of the dish of the land. So you could buy just about any kind of bird to eat. And it's amazing how many different, the variety of species that were available in the market.
Now, we're going to run out of time, and we cannot possibly do this book justice because you really drill down into a lot of detail. But eventually, the sport hunters react to the market gunners.
Yes.
And
yes.
In a really wild and complicated way, the beginning of the sort of the preservation and environmentalist movements, preserving birds and their habitat, starts with these people, these sports hunters, who are realizing this stuff that they would go out and just shoot gets wiped out. But other things are happening too. The habitat's going. A lot of other things are making everything move west, but it's the beginning of the conservation movement.
Oh, definitely. And this is part of this story that I'm tracing. It is the legal story of the transition to federal wildlife law, which the first federal wildlife laws are made about wildfowl and the market.
Yeah.
That's where the first federal laws come from. Because prior to this, there are game laws, but they're at the state level. And the legal principle that sort of guides all of wildlife lawmaking up until the 20th century is that the states have jurisdiction over wildlife within their borders. birds are a problem. Migratory birds are a problem with that because they don't stay in one state. And so if one state wants to protect their birds, it's meaningless if they pass laws because they're not protected in another state. The market adds another little wrinkle to this problem, which is that even after they're dead, birds don't stay in one state.
Right.
So if a state outlaws the market in one place, so long as there's a market somewhere else, the birds are going to go to it. So there's a real problem, and conservationists and sportsmen are starting to see that unless there's some uniformity in the laws, they won't be able to protect birds legally. And so that's when the push for federal wildlife law begins.
What's amazing, and you trace so well in the book, how much blowback there was against federal regulations.
Yes.
Tell surprise. There were really, it was a heated discussion.
Oh, definitely. And what's interesting about it is that at the beginning of this process, sportsmen are in favor of having federal law. But by the time we get to what the kind of ending point of the book here, which is the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, the state-level laws and the destruction of wildlife and the destruction of habitat have kind of shrunk the bird market to the point where it's not as significant as it had been in the 19th century. And so the biggest reaction against the Migratory Bird Treaty Act came from sportsmen. So these men that had been supporting conservation measures were now opposing it. And so there was a faction of sportsmen who were violating the law, trying to bring test cases. And eventually this leads to a Supreme Court case in 1920 that's brought by sportsmen against the federal game warden. And that's the point at which the Supreme Court comes down and says, yes, it is perfectly constitutional for the federal government to make rules about hunting and protection of birds.
There seemed to be a third front in this, too, because then there were people who were just for conservation. They didn't have a hunting chip in it, and that's where the Audubon Society starts.
Yes. But there is a connection between Audubon and sport hunters.
And this is the great thing about your book. Nothing simple.
Well, that's a historian for you.
I knew it.
We look for complicated answers. We don't look for simple answers. We look for complicated answers. But I think the story of conservation so often gets this kind of simplistic view of pro-conservation, anti-conservation. There's these two camps.
And yep.
When you find out that, well, everybody's got a different answer, and the alliances shift for a while. The conservationists and the sportsmen are on the same page. And then they aren't. And pretty soon the conservationists are saying, the problem really isn't the market hunters anymore. It's the sportsmen. They're the ones that are causing such destruction. So it's shifting alliances, and everyone sort of tries to say that they've got the purest intentions. You know, we know what the value of wildlife is, and we should be making the decisions.
It's funny because those, as I was reading this book, it was the same kind of arguments I'm hearing about fisheries today, where the fishermen are saying, we obviously know the most about the fish, not the scientists who are regulating us.
Right.
And
right.
It's the same kind of argument.
Yes. And you see these arguments even now. I was reminded of this. I was watching Yellowstone, you know, the Kevin Costner thing. And you've got this, you know, rancher in the West, and he's, the sort of Republican rancher guy, and he's pitting himself against, he's pitting himself against this sort of liberal conservationist and, you know, telling her, well, you don't know anything about the environment. You want to protect these animals, you are a vegetarian, but look, every time you plow a field, you're killing worms and insects. So you see these same arguments going on about who really knows.
Right. And the tensions, I think, are still there. I mean, even here in Massachusetts, there's still the tensions between conservation people and hunters. There's a lot of overlap in people, but there's still the same tensions that emerged in this. Is there any doubt in your mind that the Migratory Bird Treaty Act of 1918 was a really important piece of conservation legislation?
No, I mean, I think it's important. It's kind of interesting because it's important because not so much that it ended the market, although that's the first statement that says, no, it is illegal to sell wildlife, wildfowl commercially. But it's certainly important for federal jurisdiction. You don't get things like the Endangered Species Act without having these initial federal laws that break the ground to federal regulation. So I think that that's crucial in conservation history.
Writing this book, did you get really nostalgic for what had been as far as wildlife?
Yeah, in some ways, although I also got kind of hopeful, too, because...
this I need to hear.
Okay, there is some hopefulness to this in the end.
Because we did conserve, we did...
Yes, and I think that you can see the... change.
Yep. However, say, I'll tell you, some things never came back. Canvasbacks never came back to their original numbers.
Right. But I mean, I think what I find hopeful is that it just in my lifetime, I can see changes in bird populations, in certain bird populations, particularly like raptors.
Absolutely.
You know, bald eagles used to be so exotic, and now I've got bald eagles in my yard.
They breed here in the city of Worcester now. So I've been alive for that whole reintroduction in the state of we're going to have to stop here, and there's so much more we could talk about. My guest tonight has been writer Andrea L. Smalley. She's a professor emerita of history at Northern Illinois University, and she has written just an amazing book about market gunning, the market in birds, commercial hunting, conservation, and the origins of wildlife consumerism, 1850 to 1920. Andrew, it's been a real pleasure.
Well, thank you.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.